But we can't change the way they feel. Like we can't, I can't change the way anyone feels. I can give them the space, I can give them all the tools, and I can give them, the security to help them through that, but I cannot change that emotion myself. I have to just set them up to help them change it.
Welcome to the Mindset Podcast for guardians of dogs who are just a little rough around the edges. I'm your host, Kajsa van Overbeek, a life coach dedicated to making life with your challenging dog feel less challenging, both by sharing stories of other people's similar experiences and by showing you how you can harness the power of your brain to make it work for you instead of against you. I am talking to Georgie in London. And if I just say Georgie, you probably don't know who I'm talking about yet. But if I mention her Instagram handle, it's Trickwoofs. And then you might actually know who I'm talking about because you've probably seen her cartoons float around the World Wide Web as I have, because I think that was actually how I got to know about her. By looking at those cartoons and going like, oh my gosh, this is so spot on. This is perfect. This is exactly what describes the life of a reactive dog guardian. So I am super happy that she was willing to come on the podcast. And I'm just gonna, as always, hand over the mic to her and ask her to tell us a little bit about her journey, because I think there's so much there that I'm just gonna let her tell it. Georgie? Over to you.
Great. Well, thanks so much for having me. It's wonderful what you're doing. Obviously, I think it's really important that we know we are not alone when we're dealing with challenging behaviours in our dogs. So my journey, I suppose, I mentioned this to you before, I think reactivity has always found me. So on my journey to becoming a trainer, it was a natural thing that I would gravitate towards dogs with that are struggling with reactivity. My own dog became reactive. He wasn't a dog I rescued that was reactive. He was a puppy, so I took him on as a puppy from a rescue, but he became reactive to lots of things, people and dogs. He's really little and he's really nervous, so everything's pretty much scary for him. And before that, so when I was kind of studying to be a trainer and taking, my initial steps to that process, which never really ends with the studies. But that was, I was walking dogs and I was doing, like little daycares. And always I ended up taking on the reactive dogs for several different reasons. And yeah, that just became part of me, really, was they gravitated to me. And then I found I gravitated to them. So that expanded into rescue, where working in a large, very dog saturated London rescue with a lot of building work around and things. I mean, you get dogs in there that aren't reactive that become reactive because it's such an intense environment. So definitely that puts the sort of challenge on it as well, because I think one of the hardest things dealing with reactivity is when you have an environment that you just have no control over.
Wait, so first question already. The reactive dogs kind of found you on your trainer journey. What made you decide to become a trainer? Was that just something that you'd always wanted to do? Is, a lot of people that come on the podcast, the reason they become a trainer is because of one of their dogs. But if I'm hearing you correctly, for you, it was the other way around. You were a trainer first and then reactivity found you. So what got you on the training route?
Sense, actually, isn't it, when you're a trainer, reactivity is going to find you, of course. But I think we have those niches that we get into as a trainer, and that's definitely been one of mine. So yeah, I always, when I grew up, I had dogs and horses, and I grew up in a very animal world. My mum was a riding instructor, and so I was always going to go down working with animals. That was always my plan. And then in a past life, I ended up working as a fashion model. And that took me down a completely different route for a long time. But I always had this pull back. It's always something I wanted to do. I wanted to be a dog trainer. I'd see, be in all these cities and I'd see these dogs in these very saturated areas. I'd see the different dynamics in different countries, and it just was all that, always that pull in the back of my mind. But I think sometimes when you really want to do something that's your passion, you sometimes have this voice in your head that says, "Nah, you can't make a living out of something you actually want to do, right?" Sometimes there's this just thing like, could we be that deserving? Can we actually do something we enjoy for a living? So I had that kind of, self-doubt that creeps in with a lot of us all the time of, I don't know if you can make a living off being a dog trainer, that kind of thing. So it took me a long time to actually make that leap to say, you know what, I'm going to do this. I am going to study this. So eventually I kind of switched my high heels for the wellies and got
Hiking
out.
boots.
Yeah. Got to, back to the kind of life that I originally came from, which was the animal world.
So when you say it kind of took a while, was there, just to use some dog lingo, a specific trigger that then got you to say, okay, now I'm all in on this, or was it a more gradual buildup of things?
Yeah, I suppose it was a gradual build up. It was dipping in and out of courses, and it was dipping in and out of, I don't know if you have these kind of apps there where you can be a dog walker, or you kind of join an app, you don't walk dogs. People can choose you to do individual walks, but it was kind of that, doing a bit of that, looking after people's dogs, and just all of it was pulling me towards kind of working with them and kind of looking at what I was doing differently with them. And yeah, so I guess it was very gradual till I actually made that full leap and said, what am I doing? This is what I want to do. Why am I taking such slow steps to this transition? But I think sometimes it's nice to be eased in.
So then you become, was it just a full-time then dog trainer, or was it dog trainer slash walker? And then.
Initially I was walking. I had some regular walking clients and would train on the side of that. And then I kept applying for this rescue. So I really wanted to. I worked in a daycare for a little while as a trainer. It wasn't a great experience, like a lot of daycares, unfortunately, sometimes aren't. And I kept applying for this rescue. So Battersea Dogs Home in London, really big rescue, and I really wanted to work there. And I'd always had this draw. So when I would go up on the train to do my modelling jobs, you can see on the train journey, you can see the exercise areas for the dogs. And I'd always kind of look in and be like, oh, I really want to work there. I'd love to work there, So I had this pull there, and I interviewed several times and I applied several times, and eventually I got a job in the kennels there, and I worked my way up to the behaviour team. So that was probably my biggest step to fully going into it. I was working previously with sort of owners and clients and things before that, and yeah, working with clients from the daycare, but this felt like the proper leap into being a fully fledged trainer.
I know there's a lot of rescues that are now really promoting like positive reinforcement training or force retraining, whatever label you want to put on it. Was or is that the same for that Battersea rescue? Because it also sounds like they were pretty picky as to who they hire if you had to apply several
Yeah.
times. So it's not like you could just get in. You almost imagine like a rescue's dying to have people on board to help them out, but it didn't
Exactly.
sound like that was the case there.
Yeah, no, they definitely are. They're very much positive reinforcement. I think back in the day they weren't, and they made the transition a while ago to that training, and their behavior team is fantastic. It's a huge company, and there's always going to be, issues within a huge company, and working in rescue is challenging anyway, but the people that work there are just phenomenal. And I think, those that work in rescue, those that are in the kennels, those that are doing the manual work, working with those dogs, they're just such amazing people. And they, rescues often have a bad reputation of, which I know there's challenges, you know, where they don't give dog, they're too not flexible on dogs enough and this and that. But these people are just incredible. They, you know, you form fantastic bonds because you're going through a lot of compassion fatigue, but you're going through it together. So you kind of lift each other up. And yeah, they just, you know, they'll go off and they'll sneak, you know, shouldn't be spending their money on the dogs because the charity is going to help them pay for that, but they'll still sneak in a packet of cheese or something to do the training and things like that. Just, you know, and think about the dogs on their days off and worry about them. So yeah, it's just, you know, the people that do that work are, I think, are amazing.
First thing that you said was we go through compassion, or not the first thing, but one of the things we go through the compassion fatigue together. I mean, the pressure on not just dog trainers, but many dog professionals is huge. If you had to sort of define or maybe describe what compassion fatigue looks like and what the cause is, maybe even if you can say that. In the dog world, what does it look like?
I think that's a really good point. It's for me, and I think for a lot of people, it's actually looking like you don't care, and it's sometimes feeling like you don't care. And you also, I think you see it within people that have sort of perhaps not had the right support, or people that have worked in that environment for a really long time. And it's one of the reasons why I decided I had to leave rescue, because it's still definitely there within being a dog trainer, and it's a very lonely world. Sometimes we work. While we're working with clients, you know, that's we're working quite independently normally. So for me, it was, you know, I'd have these dogs that I'd work with, and if it wasn't going well, I'd feel really upset, feel really sad about it. And when I found that I didn't feel anything, then I was like, okay, something's wrong here. Something's changed. Where I'm so, you know, I think you can care so much that eventually your body just shuts down. And you kind of lose that interest in it. You lose the emotion that you should have, because it's normal to feel that if your dog's not succeeding, or you know, you're thinking that, or the dog's returned, they go to a lovely home, and you have that, oh great, they've gone home. This is amazing. It was such a challenging dog, and then they're back 2 days later. You know, you're going to feel a little bit destroyed by that, because you want the best for them. So when you stop feeling anything towards that, then that for me is very much a sign that it, you know, you've been there too long, or you're shutting down a little bit to those emotions.
Is there a way to handle that better? Because obviously the situation you just described is it's gone too far, and the way out is basically to change the circumstance, just to get out of there.
Yeah.
And what could be done, or
Yeah.
have you found a way to prevent that from happening?
Yeah, exactly. And that wasn't the sole reason why I decided to leave rescue, but it was probably a big reason. I would say, so, you know, support from each other. I think talking about it is really important, because sometimes we you know, we'll shut off from this, or we feel like, especially as trainers, we feel like we should be ha able to handle these situations. But occasionally, you know, it's we're going to feel challenged. And sometimes when we're working really closely with a case, and this happened in rescue as well, you can, like when you're working with your own dog, sometimes we can't see anything else because we're so close, we're so focused on, you know, that dog and everything we've done, that we can't take that step back and look at the bigger picture. And so it's nice sometimes when we'd be working on a dog and we hit a wall, which is really normal when you're doing training, we just come in and talk to, you know, the other members of the team and say, I don't know what's going on here. I'm not getting anywhere. I feel like I've done, and they might come up with something that's so obvious, but you're so close, you don't see it. So they'll go, well, have you tried this, or have you done this? And you go, ah, oh, that's what I need to do. Yeah, you're right. And I think that's, you know, just communicating. It's never a flaw to ask for help. And I think sometimes we feel that, especially see it a lot in new trainers, where they take on a case, perhaps an aggression case, that they maybe weren't ready for, or the behavior is too challenging. But it's really scary to say, do you know what, this is too much for me, could I pass it on to you, and could I shadow you and learn from that? And that's quite a big brave step sometimes, I find, but that can really help take the pressure off us a little bit. But yeah, I think I'm going off track a little bit, but with the compassion fatigue, I think it's finding that support, doing what works for you. So for me, I think, yoga, meditation, breath work is really good for the way I feel. But it's, some people will find they do better with boxing, getting out that way, or mountain climbing. But whatever gets it out, having that thing that you can completely switch your mind to something else and switch off and find an escape from that, because I think a lot of it comes from not knowing how to turn off. Going home at night and still thinking about these dogs in kennels, going home at night and still thinking about your client's dog is, and how are they getting on, and are they doing the right thing, or are they okay? We find it really hard to switch off because we went into this job because we love dogs and we're really attached to them. So we find it difficult to say, it's not my dog. I can switch off from it. That's okay. They've got someone looking after them.
Is that the thought? Maybe it's okay they have someone looking after them, because if I heard you correctly, then the switching off part is also a part that can trigger guilt. As in, if I now switch off and say don't think about it anymore, then that is to be interpreted as I don't care. Switching
Yeah.
off is not caring.
Yeah, definitely can absolutely can trigger guilt, can't it? But we shouldn't feel guilty for that, because if we don't take that time for self-care, then we're not giving the dogs the best version of ourselves. We're giving them a tired out, probably triggered, probably more reactive ourselves state, because we're so overwhelmed. We're so, I have always used the word overstimulated with dogs and when we're doing dog training, but I've heard it a lot lately used for people, but on look, because I watch lots of parenting things as well, sort of gentle parenting. And I was like, that is so, I never even thought of it in a human context. But often we are overstimulated. We're overstimulated by, the amount of stuff we're taking on, the amount of, reactions from our dogs. We can also feel that overwhelm. So we are then triggered, or we are more reactive in those circumstances. So if we switch off, we're doing a service for our dogs. We're taking that time to recharge, come back calmer, come back more patient, come back with a better energy. So our dogs are going to go, oh, like seeing you. And we're going to have a much better time together and a better experience.
I'm just thinking, because I always say that we're no different from our dogs. We're mammals, we're sentient beings. Half of the stuff, no, I want to say probably 90% of the stuff that applies to our dog's behavior applies to us as well. So I'm just now thinking of what would be the dog version of the switching off, but it's like we're implementing our own relaxation protocol. Like we need to relax and come down from whatever level we're at so that we can recharge, and then start with our empty bucket instead of the one that's already filled to
So
the
true.
brim.
I think we need decompression walks as well, because, I think one of the best things I've done for myself is to go for walks without my dog, which sounds crazy, but it's if you're always, I found after, working in rescue and always handling dogs that are reacting, I became so reactive myself. Someone walks around the corner with a dog and I'm like, whoa. I'm like, my goodness, I'm having bigger reactions than, some of the dogs will. So I was like, sometimes I need to remind myself that, okay, we just need to change that mindset. I don't need to do a U-turn. I don't need to duck behind don't need to get out the magnet can. I can just walk past. And we need to decompress ourselves too, otherwise we become, just as reactive as our dogs, and then we're kind of both going together.
So, did you start sort of including this type of information, maybe is the way to call it, with your dog training clients right from the start? Or was this, again, also a gradual process? Do you even include it? Do you talk about it? Is it part of what you do?
Yeah, definitely. I think definitely it was a gradual process, I'd say, because when you start, I think you're really focused on the dog and how can we change the dog's behavior? How can we do this? And it took me a little while to get to the people side, which is mainly the probably biggest part, and seeing how affected people are as well. When I find a lot of people say, "Is my dog reactive?" And they want that confirmation. It's almost, I know they don't necessarily like labels, but sometimes I think that's a label that provides people with relief because they say, yes, a trainer has said they're reactive. Therefore, I know why I'm finding it much harder than other people to walk this dog or to own a dog or to be responsible for this dog because they're a little bit more challenging. Deeply feeling, I heard that used on a parenting blog, deeply feeling kids. And
Oh.
a lovely word for our dogs if they're not reactive, but they feel things more deeply. And so yeah, it was probably a gradual process, but I do definitely use that. I focus a lot on people and that kind of mindset and just how we can make things better for them. How can we practice self-care into their routine? Because there's no point working on the dog if we've got someone that's just incredibly anxious when they go out and feels very judged and feels, very much like they're, doing everything wrong. We need to focus on building them up first, and then we can get to the dog.
Your own dog? Is it your current dog that is reactive?
Yeah.
Did you have a hard time with that yourself? Or was this more of, I already have this information. I've been working in rescue. I don't know if there was an overlap between your work there and you having your current dog. Was that easier for you to do? Or did you struggle just like any ordinary, I want to say, reactive dog guardian?
Yeah, I would say, you have the tools in place to be able to handle it, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're in your mind it's going to be easier. And if anything, you feel even more judged because you're a trainer. You shouldn't have a reactive dog. And so the more you get, I used to be like, oh, hope if he was having a bad day, hope I don't run into any clients because I felt like I was judged. I should have a perfectly behaved dog. And which he is, he's awesome, but he has some things going on. So yeah, I think almost it can almost play more of a havoc on your mental, your mindset and your mental health because you feel more pressured to have this ideal dog. And perhaps even as trainers, we sometimes do have more challenging dogs. Maybe one because we have the capabilities to take on that behavior, but also I sometimes think we can overmanage a little bit, and that's why it's really important not to lose a little bit of that owner side because often we see like we're perhaps overmanaging dog-to-dog situations. We perhaps overmanage people a little bit. It's always good to stick up for our dogs and advocate and do what we can, but I don't know about you, but I definitely find sometimes if my dog had just been left to kind of get himself out of trouble and handle the situation, it probably would have gone better because stress isn't always a bad thing. Sometimes we need to go through certain levels of stress and let our body release the cortisol, fight it, and then next time they go through that stressful event, they're gonna handle it a little bit better, and they're going to be a little bit calmer about it. That's the process, but providing it's not huge. We haven't got dog charging up and terrorizing them, but if it's perhaps just walking past the dog that had a little bark, that's okay if the dog's able to get out and control that stress and move themselves away. So yeah, I do sometimes think, well, definitely me personally can overmanage situations, but yeah, it's been a journey with him, and he goes back and forth, and I think that's a really important thing to know with a reactive dog. When people are working through depression or anxiety, I don't know if we ever completely make it go away, but I think we do get better at tools used to work with it, to handle it, to get ourselves through it. So while he might go for a year without being reactive to anything, it might come back because our situations change. I've had a baby that's hugely changed his routine. That's added more stress to our walk. So the reactivity came back during that time. Now he's 11 and he's a bit stiff, and I know he feels a bit more vulnerable and he's perhaps a bit arthritic. reactivity is coming back a bit there as well, which is understandable because he's feeling more vulnerable and less likely that he can get away. So we have to just go back and forth with our work. You know, for a year I might not work on it. Oh, it's creeping back in. There's something going on here. Let's check medical, let's check change in routine like we do, and then support it again and go back through.
I love that you actually made that link also to depression and things like that. I think the killer thought that I've noticed pops up in my head and also with my clients as well is I thought I'd dealt with this. I thought we were done with this now, or I thought we were over this. And then that's almost the painful one, like when behavior does come back, and then this thought is, I thought we dealt with this. I thought I was done. There comes this huge resistance of no, I don't want to go through this again. No. You know, and I think a nice way of looking at it is, I heard someone say this, like sometimes, you know, like you're in the vortex, which means like you're dealing with the reactivity, for example, in cases of depression, like it seems like it's gone away, you're all there, and then you just get, you know, flung out, and that's normal. And all you have to do is just choose to step right back into it. And then that into the vortex, right, is what they were saying. And I think that's a nice way of saying, like, yeah, that just happens, you know, like it takes you a little bit of to, it just happens. Instead of, oh gosh, I thought we were done with this. It just triggers another trigger, triggers a different emotion that allows you to deal with it a little bit better. I also wanted to ask you about overmanaging, because right now I'm noticing, I'm just going to talk about myself for a bit because I can. With my dog, with Rusty, I've been managing a lot, which has done wonders for his reactivity. Absolutely. At the same time, I also have a friend who runs a dog walking service daycare. She also invests a lot in educating herself on training, but our philosophies do differ. And I noticed that what she's working on a lot is also letting the dogs interact with supervision, but giving them more of a chance to sort of figure it out, I want to say. And I'm right now where I'm at is like, okay, so when are we, like you said, where's the boundary? Like, when are we over managing, and when do we actually need to give our dogs a way to, you know, like to practice? Like, sometimes we have to practice skills too to get better at it. And how do you do it in, I guess, in a responsible way? I didn't like, what's your take on that?
It's a tricky one, isn't it? But I think there's a gut feeling as well, and perhaps in when we're in a daycare environment, just using that as an example, we've got a lot of dogs in there that would perhaps space is limited, perhaps stress is higher, perhaps they wouldn't choose maybe to interact with those dogs, but they're in a small space and they have less choices. So that's a situation I would perhaps overmanage because, you know, I see so many problems, and not saying that you can't do it right. There are plenty of people out there doing lovely daycares and are, you know, keeping it happy and safe. But I do see a lot of problems come from daycare because dogs aren't protected enough and they don't feel like they have any choices. So, you know, there's always this thing of they're really reactive, but they're fine in daycare. But what that always spells to me is perhaps there's a problem in daycare and they're actually suppressing that behavior. And the reactivity is coming out in places where they feel more safe to do so. But when in a more sort of controlled setup where you've perhaps got one-on-one dogs, so I used to take in a lot of foster dogs, and a lot of it was intuition. So there'd sometimes be this amazing communication between my dog and these foster dogs where I didn't feel like I needed to step in. I wouldn't even say, you know, it wouldn't even need to be so far as a lip raise. It would be a hey, a look, you know, and the other dog would say, okay, my dog food is very important to him. So they'd say, okay, I don't go near you when you've got food. That's fine. You know, obviously still managing it with barriers and what we need to do, keeping things safe. But there's some dogs that I could just say, you guys can figure this out because you've got a lovely thing going on where you're just communicating beautifully. And, and then my dog might look at them with a toy and say, "That's all yours. I get that. I'm going to stay away from you." It's just it's really nice to just see this really subtle communication where I can let them kind of figure it out. But then there'd be some that I'd probably manage a lot more because I'm like, not sure about you guys. You're kind of silent around each other. And sometimes, without that play or when they go into real independent mode, it looks good. But there's little niggles that you see and you think, okay, you guys need more management.
Yeah,
So
more
I,
tension underneath, probably.
yeah, definitely. And just no communication. So, I think play is quite good when you're doing introductions with dogs because it really helps them learn about each other and connect. Whereas if they've gone into that, okay, I'm going to accept you in my space, I'm going to accept you in my space, then we just have to make sure that that's going to continue. Because if there's zero communication, that's always a little bit of a worry. But yeah, I think so. It's trusting your gut a little bit. If a dog sort of, and looking at our dogs, I think that's really important. Sometimes if I feel tense, say a dog's run over to my dog and I feel a bit tense, I'll sometimes walk away because my dog's social underneath and he knows what he's doing. And there's times when, a dog sort of run over a bit. And, sometimes you get tense dogs that have a bit of a play growl, they're a bit of vocal. And I'll say, "Ooh." And my dog will go, "Hello, mate." And I'll say, "Okay, I'm going to walk away," and he's going to deal with that. Where other times I might see his tail go under and say, "Oh, I'm not sure about this," and then I might step in. So it's looking at our dog's body language of when can you handle this situation? Perhaps it's just me that's feeling tense. You look like you've got this. I'm going to be here if you need me, but I'm just going to take a slight step away.
What allows you to do that, to say, to take that basically distance from yourself and say, okay, now I'm gonna, because it takes some mental space to still be able to do that. So what's underneath that?
I suppose it's knowing your dog, and I think it's going back to that body language of your individual dog, because we can focus on body language and we can brush up on it and we can get really good at it, but I don't think we ever really know until we watch our own dogs all the time. What do they do when they're a little bit uncomfortable? What do they do when they're super happy? What do they do when they've got this? Because they're having those silent conversations with dogs, and you can kind of start to see those. So the little, like my dog would flick his whiskers. If he's unhappy, his whiskers will flick forwards. It's a really cute little body language thing from him. So if his whiskers are tense, I know I need to take action. So I think that's really important to know your dog really well and step in there and kind of, maybe it comes with practice, maybe it comes with a bit of intuition, but I think where you can perhaps, I even do these kind of ignorant owner walks sometimes where I'll just walk around, I'll pretend that I don't know anything. I go back to those times because knowledge is great, right? But sometimes it's a bit of a burden. I mean, I don't know if you walk around the dog park and you think, "Oh, that dog's not enjoying that play interaction. Oh, that dog doesn't look happy. Oh, what's he doing?" And
Yep.
sometimes I just go, "Do you know what? I'm just gonna be an owner today. I'm just gonna walk around. I like that dog's running and playing. He looks like he's having a great time. That dog's going after a ball over and over again. That looks great." And so I think sometimes we just need to do that so that we can, just relax a little bit more. It's hard. It's definitely a process, and it's something I'm still working on for sure. But just trying not to be that kind of, helicoptering, they call it, don't they, where
Yeah,
you're
helicopter parenting, helicopter dog guardianing. It's a new word.
Since someone mentioned that to me, I hear the helicopter in my head when I'm off again. So yeah, it's just trying, and we're really focused on when we learn about those stress body language signals, we get really obsessed with it and we put it all on ourselves. "Oh my God, my dog's stressed. I need to fix that. I need to do this." But we can't change the way they feel. Like we can't, I can't change the way anyone feels. I can give them the space. I can give them all the tools, and I can give them, the security to help them through that, but I cannot change that emotion myself. I have to just set them up to help them change it.
Yeah, and I think thinking back to how I coach humans, and I think it's also thinking back to parenting since we're drawing the parallels to that as well. Emotions aren't always bad, like stress per se isn't always bad. Being afraid of something isn't always bad. You know, even in parenting, we tend to go like, our kids frustrated or our kids angry or sad, and we're like, what can I do to fix this for you? But what if there's nothing to be fixed? What if being angry is just okay? You know, it's just a way of handling stuff. Like, obviously no one likes to see their kid in pain or stress or whatnot, but it is just an emotion, and it's just an indicator that something was going on for them that they maybe that they care about. If we can help them sort of deal with the emotion, then maybe we don't even need to prevent or fix it. And I think sometimes with even with my dog, you know, sometimes he's just afraid or he's jumpy, and I'm like, oh, did that make you jump? I just kind of let him come down from it and be like, yeah, I realized that I was jumpy. That was a loud sound or something of the sort, without thinking like, oh, he shouldn't be jumpy. He shouldn't be afraid of that. Like, the goal is never to have a scare or never to have a stressful moment. I think just changing that perspective a little bit can help.
Totally, and take that pressure off us a little bit. You know, it's these feelings are a normal, and I think sometimes it's a stress release, you know, when you're saying about children, perhaps toddlers having tantrums. And, you know, that's, I think that's part of their releasing stress, is they need to get it out. They need to scream, and we can say that, okay, I'm here if you need me, but you get it out. You know, you need to go through those emotions. You need to have those big feelings. And it's the same with our dogs. You know, we get such a lot of judgment in both scenarios. You know, if a kid's having a tantrum, you get a lot of looks like, oh, what are you going to do about that kid? And it's perceived as they're really playing up, they're really being naughty. But, and the same with our dogs. Wow, that dog's really barking. What's the owner going to do about it? So we feel like we should be seen saying, don't do that, behave yourself. You know, we're in public. Whereas actually we just need to calmly take control of the situation. Okay, my dog's got over threshold. Whoopsie, let's just get him out of this situation. Okay, kids having a big meltdown. Let's just stay here calmly till they've got through it. You know, rather than feeling this pressure to be showing a big response to this because it's not what society expects the behavior should be.
Although jokingly, I think children throwing a tantrum and things like that, where you were saying earlier, having community helps, having other people going through the same thing helps. What I love now is like when I see a kid throwing a tantrum, because mine are teenagers, right? So I've been through that stage. When I see a kid throwing a tantrum in the supermarket, and I see a parent like react really coolly to it, I'm like, yeah. You got this. Like, I've been there, you know, you're doing it all right. This is like this whole of not judging someone for it, but going like, yeah, I know those tantrums, you know, they couldn't have the candy they wanted. Oh, I know, super frustrating. You're doing awesome, you know, like
Exactly.
this whole community thing. So I want to bring this back to now maybe your Instagram and your cartoons, because in the end, that is how I found you. Like, how did that come about? Because you mentioned you did modeling work, but if you had said I was doing drawing or was an artist before, I would have gone like, yeah, that totally makes sense. I see the connection. But what is the connection?
I suppose I need to link that in. So what I was also doing while I was growing up with all the animals was I was also drawing, and that's always been something I've done is to draw. And I, you know, I'm self-taught, so I did pop into art college for a bit, but didn't last. And so it's always just been me, you know, drawing, which I've always done everywhere I've gone. It's my hobby, it's my stress relief, it's my, you know, it's my meditation, I suppose. I find it really helps me. So I've always done drawings to go with training stuff to explain, because when I study, when I do courses, I'm a doodler rather than note taker. I'll draw things because that helps my brain sort of process information. So, you know, if I'm learning about the brain, I'll have to draw the brain, I have to draw all the bits, and that's going to help me do it. So because I'm so visual, it's always how I've relayed information to other people and making it simple. So I used to be very, I used to do painting. I used to be really into realism. Everything had to look real. Everything had to be perfect. I wanted to look a dog to look exactly like a dog. And as I moved to smaller and smaller apartments, getting out paints, getting out colored pencils became harder and harder. And when I had a baby, I had no time because, that realism stuff takes 30 plus hours. And I was like, gosh, I don't have time to do this anymore. And I'd always been a bit resistant to working with digital art because, it didn't feel right. It wasn't holding a pencil, it wasn't a paper. It was like, how a Kindle might feel, not reading a book. So I was a bit resistant, but I thought I'll have a go because it's right there. I don't have to get anything out and I can do it quickly. And I just drew the first, digital style, which was just silly and a silly dog, and it quickly picked up, more sort of people interested in that because I think it was the imperfections and the kind of, the silliness of the drawings that people related to. It wasn't all trying to be perfect, which is exactly what we shouldn't be doing in our training. We shouldn't be looking at the perfect dog. We shouldn't be looking at the perfect journey. So that became what people related to, and definitely the more, as I realized that the more kind of, how do you say it, like, the self kind of help things and the ones that were more connected to the way we feel about our training really connected with people. And I was like, of course, that's what people need, because this does still feel quite lonely sometimes when you're dealing with challenging behaviors.
Just as a tech geek now for a second, when you say I'm not drawing on paper, do you draw digitally directly, like on a tablet or on?
Yeah, on a tablet.
Cool. I thought maybe you would draw and then scan or digitize or do like in Illustrator, like redo it or whatnot, but directly on tablet. Sorry, just aside. This is an aside. How do you come up with the ideas? Because I look at your cartoons and they basically say what I also teach my clients in coaching, but you do it so concisely. And so, like, I look at it and I'm like, I can't think of explaining it the way she does. Like, she does this in one cartoon with like one sentence. And you might not even be aware of the how, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Like, how do you do that? How do you decide the words, the language, the imagery? Like, where does that come from?
Oh, thank you. To be honest, yeah, I don't really know. I think whenever I'm training, whenever I'm doing a course, or even, talking to you, the ideas pop up into my head. I think, oh, that would make a good cartoon. That would make a good cartoon. I was even out, with my family the other day. I said, oh, I thought of a cartoon for that. And they said, God, do you ever think of anything else? And I said, well, no, I guess because they pop into my head. So I always write them down now because, I'll put a little note on my phone when they pop up so I can then let it go. So I'm not obsessing about it. And yeah, I don't really know. I think they just come up. But obviously some of them don't work. I think, there might be some that people really get. I think sometimes some of it is all in my head and people are like, oh, I don't really get that one. So it's not always the consistency, but yeah, some of them I think help explain. I guess it's connecting to that, to our sort of way we can understand it, which is the more person side. And it's not always bad to kind of humanize our dogs because they do feel the same emotions that we do. Yes, we still want to remember they're animals and they're their own species, but it's we can connect when we can connect them to us, I think we can understand them a little bit better.
I also think that science is doing that more and more, right? We were a couple of decades ago, I want to say. I think biology was very much saying, okay, we cannot in any way anthropomorphize animals. Like, we can't give them emotions and things. We really have to say, like, even just something like jealousy, it's in dogs, it's resource guarding. We can't call our dogs jealous. And I think that is changing now, but I was going to say years ago that this was very much it. I remember taking biology in high school and my biology teacher really saying like, no, you have to be super factual. You have to really describe like everything you see. And you can't attribute any humanness to it. But that is for sure changing now. Like there's so much research now going into emotions in animals. Even the whole concept of metacognition, you know, like thinking about our thinking is where they're saying like, okay, this used to be like a human only trait. And now they're doing research as into like, okay, but oh, okay, there's animals that have it too. So I think those two are coming closer together. And again, to me, that makes sense because like I said, we're animals too. It's not like we're just like this unique species. I mean, all species are unique, but why wouldn't there be overlap? Why wouldn't there be
Totally.
emotions?
I think that's so important because obviously we're all about the science and we're science-based and things like that, but it's also good to keep your mind open. I mean, I think there's a, you know, we knew that adolescence existed in dogs for a long time, but we didn't get that proved by science till quite recently. So it's, I think it's until we can't prove it, I think when it comes to emotions, we should assume that they do feel the same. You know, it doesn't mean that. I think it's just changing our mindset. I think it used to come from the fact that our dogs know they've done wrong because they ate that thing when I went out and I left. So I came back and they looked guilty. But it's not about us humanizing them that makes us react in that way that they should have known better. I think it's just changing our mindset. We, you know, they took an opportunity. They're dogs. They took an opportunity, and what some people would too. If we left a child alone with a chocolate cake, they'd probably eat it, you know,
For
because we
sure.
at that, you know, rational thinking side of the brain, we have that more of a survival brain. And if we look at where emotions come from, they're coming from the survival brain. They're, you know, fear is coming from to keep a dog safe, and you know, the resources that desire and seek is to get resources, and then they want to keep a hold of them. That's all survival instinct, but that could, you know, come from jealousy. And then we've got lust, and you know, which would be the desire to reproduce. So it's all coming from something that would keep them surviving and keep them reproducing. So I think it's better to assume they do feel emotions and then get proved wrong rather than assume they don't before we get proved wrong.
I like that. I do like also how you do the parallels in your cartoons where you're like, well, I just can't think of one right off the top of my head, but well, maybe just even reactivity, you know, like when the dog's barking and then you put it side by side with the human kind of screaming, you're like, yeah, we're doing the same thing. For me, the one that really stood out, and I think it's, I don't know why that one triggered me contacting you, I have no idea, but it did. Was one where you showed the dog and the dog was saying, I think the human in the cartoon was saying something like, I think today we're just not going to do anything. I don't feel like we're going to do anything. We're just going to do nothing. And then the dog had this little thinking balloon that said, like, oh, those are always my favorite days. They always turn out the best, something like that. And whenever I see those cartoons, I sort of start thinking, like, from a mindset perspective, like, why is that? And that cartoon for me triggered the whole sometimes as a human, we get into this, okay, we have to do this. Like we have to do this amount of training with our dog. We still have to, I don't know, work on cooperative care, or we have to rent that sniff spot or whatever it is. Like we have to, we have to, we have to. And that puts so much pressure that in the end, shuts us down. And then going for a day where like we don't have to do anything, like already deciding we don't have to do anything takes so much of the pressure off that in the end you often end up doing more because you're like, I don't have to do anything, but now I feel like doing this. And then, you know, like this is my interpretation of your cartoon, of that cartoon where the dog goes like, oh, these are my favorite days. I'm like, yeah, because when you take the pressure off, you're actually more inclined to do stuff with your dog. I have no idea if that's how you meant it, but I think that's always the fun part about art is everybody gets to interpret it the way they
Exactly, but
want.
is exactly how I meant it, and it is kind of making things more sustainable for us because, if I want to include yoga into my daily routine, I started not thinking I'm going to do a 10-minute yoga class or I'm going to do a 30-minute yoga thing. I'm just going to sit on the floor today. I'm just going to sit on the floor cross-legged. And from there, and that's doable. If you think like that, you think I can do that. And then from there you think, well, I might as well just do a little bit of stretching and you end up probably doing, a
Way
little bit of.
more.
And it's the same with our dogs. If we think, right, we need to set this up and do this training. But if we actually just think, right, while the kettle's boiling or, while I'm standing in the kitchen, I'm just going to get these treats. I'm just going to throw my dog a couple of treats, one over there, one over there. And from there, we usually start doing a little bit more with our dogs because we've already got the treats out and we started doing it. And it's just starting with that. And if that's all we do, then that's fine. But exactly that, if we kind of give ourselves permission not to do anything, then often we have the space, the headspace to do more.
From the not to do anything, you definitely don't do nothing. I don't know how this is going with the double negatives, but you do a lot. So, okay, so that now there's training, there's the Instagram presence with the cartoons. I think you also do cartoons for other people, right? Professionally, if they want to, correct me if I'm wrong. And then there's the whole muzzle project, which also had me go like, wait, what's she doing there? Like, how? And you're a mom, so how do you do all of that? How do you?
I don't sleep much. No, definitely not saying that's a good thing. It's sometimes a bit of a struggle, I think. It's difficult to focus on one thing sometimes when you've got so much going on in your brain, but there's definitely a lot going on. But I do probably work when my daughter goes to sleep, I do work throughout the evenings, most evenings. So that's how I fit it in, I guess. But it's also, that finding little slots of working, not necessarily all the time, but consistently. So I try to just consistently do little bits for myself each day, but not to overwhelm and make sure I'm trying, each slot is each area where I'm doing something, I'm trying to give it my all. So, if I'm working with a client, I want to give them all of me and making sure that when I'm with my daughter, I switch off the electrical devices and she gets all of me, which is a process. I'm not saying that that's what I do, but that's what I'm trying to do to try and get that balance because I think sometimes it can be quite hard to find that balance.
How do you deal with it when you don't? This is a nasty question, but like,
Yeah, beat myself up internally. Well, that's what sometimes I want to do, but I think it's you. I think the voice inside you is really important and. That's something that I'm really working on is making that voice much nicer to me because we sometimes are our worst person to ourselves. So I always change that narrative. If I start off with my little, oh, you've been really distracted today. You've been, you haven't been a good mum. You haven't done. Then I say, ah, no, you're not going to speak to me like this. I'm doing the best I can. I interrupt that voice now and I completely change it. And it's the same with anything in our brain. If we start to change the way where our brain wants to go, because it's all the neurons are firing at the moment. My neurons have fired so long to that negative thoughts that I have to keep correcting it, and I have to keep doing that. And I step in as soon as I possibly can. Same as if we might be changing reactive behavior,
Yeah.
I need to open the other pathway of being nice to myself to eventually, when I'm like, oh, I'm having a bad day, I'm going to go, that's okay. You're doing the best you can, but it's a process.
I love that you're saying that because, again, this is sort of the whole vortex thingy again. You know, like there might be a time where everything is going great. You're being super kind to yourself. If something goes wrong, you're like, yeah, that happens. And then there will be times where you kind of go like, yeah, you fall into the beating yourself up pattern. You're out of the vortex and you just all you have to do is get back in. I still want to get to ask you a little bit more about the whole muzzle thing because I know what it's about, but not everybody listening to us might know what it's about. And I think it's so fun because it's a completely different I mean, it's not different as in that it has to do with dogs, but it's a completely different way of, I don't know what it is, entrepreneurship maybe, because it's not about providing a service. You're now developing a product, which again is gonna probably get you out of your comfort zone and make you deal with things that you've never had to deal with before. So just give us the short spiel of like what decide or what made you decide to develop and design a new muzzle and all of that went into it. And then maybe, elaborate a little bit on possible discomfort that you might have felt and ways that you've overcome it.
Definitely. I mean, it's a journey for sure. So it's a treat dispensing muzzle, and as you can imagine, I, wanted to bring this into the world because I work with a lot of dogs that wear muzzles, and I just found giving them a treat was just so chat, by the time you want to reward them at the right time, but by the time you've threaded that treat through the hole, or they've got frustrated because it's all exploded and gone on the floor and they can't get to it. So it's a common thing we see. I just wanted to be able to give a dog a treat while they were comfortable in their muzzle. So I it's been a years. It's been going on for years where I for a long time I was doing drawings and I thought, how could this work? And I talked to other people and they're like, this can't work. And I was like, no, it can. And I ended up speaking to an engineer. I said, I've got this idea that I really want to make possible, but I don't think it is possible. And he said, well, nothing's impossible. I was like, okay, you're the right guy for the
Right.
job. So he's helped me, develop the mechanism and everything. And yeah, it's a journey because it's definitely that side is definitely, I like the invention side. I have a lot of ideas, but the business side is a big struggle for me. So I've been trying to add in some business courses and try to get to the point where I can make this a reality. Because we've gone through a lot of different prototypes, and it's been a challenge in the fact that there is a lot of things against it. What are you doing? Why are you coming up with this idea? This idea is ridiculous. Why are you spending money on this? You're making such bad choices. You get that a lot, like people questioning you. And I heard this quote. There's a guy called Paul Brunson. He's like a relationship coach. He does sort of TV shows and stuff, but he also does quite a lot of business. But he said, you're an idiot before you're brilliant. And that helped me go a little bit. I really like that because he said, every time you come up with a good idea, people are going to tell you're an idiot for making these. You have to have these kind of leaps and perhaps do something stupid before it might work. So I really liked that quote. That was one that kept me going along.
Yeah.
I was like, maybe after all this being an idiot, I'll be brilliant one point. So, and it's just things like that. I think it's even if something doesn't work, you can say that you've tried. You can say that, you're going to go there and say, I had this idea and I gave it a really good go to make it reality because for me, it could make a huge difference to the training world. I mean, for me, it would make a massive difference if we could just make that process smoother, if we could, get a dog just easily being able to take that treat. So it's just pop, reward, and we don't have to go through this threading and remove some of that frustration. So yeah, it's still an ongoing process. We've had the latest prototype was tiny, ready to fit my dog, which was a really little one to see how small we could go. But so it's super cute and yeah, it's getting there. It's getting there.
So just from like a steps point of view, right? Because a lot of people, when they're talking about things like this, it's I found an engineer, we now have a small prototype, and my brain always goes, what about all the steps in between?
Yeah.
How did you find an engineer in the first place? Then who did you contact to do prototyping? How do you go about that? And then, of course, you filed for a patent. And this is I told you before we started recording, my background, aside from like aerospace engineering first, was being a patent examiner at the European Patent Office for almost 20 years. So patents are, I don't want to say my jam because now it's coaching, but they were for a long part of my life. So it does pique my interest when I hear, oh my gosh, patent pending. But just so all these practicalities, because you have to start thinking about that. You have to find the guy. You have to then consider materials. Like, is this the guy helping you with that? Or what do you do? Where do you get the prototype made? All these tiny decisions that go into that.
Yeah.
I want to know all about that.
The engineer's been massively helpful with all the prototype, the manufacturing quotes and stuff. So he covers a lot of that. The way I found him was there's a site here where you can say what you want. So it could be dog training, it could be marketing, and you put your information on and you get loads of quotes back, or you get loads of people contacting you, which I've used as a dog trainer. There's a lot of dog trainers on there. And I saw him on there, and I actually know where to contact people. You have to pay to contact each person, which is sometimes you contact 10 people and you get one person comes back because some people are just putting the feelers out. So I found his website and I contacted him directly so that he wouldn't have to do that. I'm gonna speak to you. And I think a lot of it is, I always go on these things as intuition. I think sometimes you just get a feel of whether someone's right for you or not. So when I spoke to him, he's really young and kind of upbeat and fresh, which I thought I need that. I need someone that's going to take on this challenge. And he just got a dog, and I was like, perfect.
Yeah.
So that was how I chose him, and he's been fantastic with all those things that I find really overwhelming. So he's sorted the prototype because he works with a lot of manufacturers. He's also made one of the prototypes through 3D printing. And the first prototype came back, looked great, but the lid would fall off and the end would fall off, and the lid came off, all the treats fell out, the dog's trying to get the treats. I was like, okay, this isn't working. So
Dog had a good day, though.
so every kind of prototype comes back, you're like, yes, and then there's a little something where you're like, no, that's not quite right. And then so we changed, the lid's much better now, it's attached, the treat dispense part stays on really well, and it's that, but each one it's just that little thing, okay, that's not quite right, so we need to fix that, and that's not quite, so we need to fix that. So it's definitely a journey. And I think, to be honest, if I was a large company, I probably would have just put it out by now, but because I've got that train of mine, I need to be like, no, it's got to work perfectly. So it's the steps are that, just keep getting the prototype, keep testing, keep deciding what needs to be changed, and that kind of thing, and looking into a Kickstarter of how I was hoping to eventually launch. But it's hugely challenging. I mean, I go back and forth all the time saying I want to give up, or I just want to sell the whole thing, or it's too much for me, it's too much for me now, and I just go back and forth on it all the time. And I think that's part of the journey and part of the process.
Do you have a specific thought that keeps you at it? Or maybe it's the everybody's an idiot first thought, but maybe it's a different one.
Yeah, a few of them. I think there's something in me that keeps me going. I've done a lot of business ideas that I do and I fail, and I've had, I think that you do that to, I don't think that that's a bad process. And I think some people will always do that. I think if an idea fails, it's not failed. It's given you so much insight because you've learned so much. Every time I do this, and I mean, looking back from when I first started, I didn't know about patents. I didn't know about, prototypes or manufacturers or how all that works. So I've now got all that information from this journey. So it's never a waste of time, and it all pushes you forwards. So I suppose that's it. I kind of look at that little thing of as to why I've never given up yet. And that's kind of say, because you're supposed to keep going, you're supposed to keep going.
I hear that, and I imagine that there is also a voice that says, but you're investing all this time and let's face it, money in it as well. So have you set a point beforehand where you say, okay, if I've spent, let's say, X amount of money and time and it's not worked by then, I'm pulling the plug? Or how do you deal with this nagging of, oh my gosh, this is like more money being sunk into this?
I mean, definitely. And at this time, I've kind of had to put a pause on it to slow down a bit because, yeah, my situation has changed a bit. So at the moment, I'm kind of on a pause, but I just really want to see it out there because I think there's a place for it. And it's become kind of more like, it's become like my baby where I want to see good things happen to it. So it's there, and I don't want to give up on it, but yeah, it's definitely, you hit a point where you have to say, okay, let's rethink this. Let's see where we're going with this. And
Well, we're not there yet. We're just at pause.
yeah, we're at pause. We're at pause. I have, there's still something about it that says we're going to get there, but yeah, I just have to pause on it because of money.
Yeah, if only we had unlimited funding, it'd be great, wouldn't it?
Exactly. I mean, that would be, yeah, that'd make life much easier. But that's maybe the this is to slow us down because we're not supposed to rush for it.
Oh, I love that. I love that switch, the rethink of it. Probably makes you more likely to continue when the time is right, thinking about it that way.
Yeah, exactly. And again, it's that voice, isn't it, inside that's you have enough of that from other people that you don't need to do it to yourself. You can always be that nice voice to yourself.
I love that. I know we've gone sort of a little bit all over the place and maybe not entirely dog reactivity per se, but this is also a mindset podcast after all. So I just love digging into all those aspects. Tell me, what do you still want to talk about? Like, what is dear and near to your heart?
Oh, well, I think we've covered so much. I think, all the mindset, the compassion fatigue, that's pretty much what I always want to get out there is there's, that people aren't alone when they're dealing with challenging behaviors. I think there's a lot of support for young mums now with, with human babies, and there isn't a lot of support for people that get puppies or get dogs or take on perhaps rescue dogs with challenging behaviors, or, so I think the more that we talk about it and realize that we aren't alone is what's really important, because there's still that side of, when you have a puppy, you're still mourning that same loss that you do when you have a baby of the life you had before, because you don't have as much freedom. You are responsible for another being, and that can really take its toll on you. So, both are really challenging, but one is much more widely accepted as being challenging, where the other is thought of as, you've got a dog, it's just a dog, it should be easy, it's nice, take it for walks. But that's actually not the reality when we care. And I think the fact that we do feel guilt, we do feel, worry and concern for our dogs is just a really lovely sign that we are doing a great job because we care for them.
That's what I also always say. The fact that we worry and the fact that we get angry and the fact that we get upset actually means that we care. Because if we didn't and we just all be like about it, I think that would be even worse. I do also very much like that you mentioned the mourning of the life that you had before. And I think this is true both when you have kids and when you have a dog. I think one of the most hurtful comments can be, do you know what you were getting into when, like when you got kids, you knew what you were getting into when you got a dog. So you knew you wouldn't be able to go out as much anymore. So I don't want to hear you complain about it. And it's sort of this type of reasoning. And I think, yes, we knew what we were getting into, maybe with the reactive dog, not so much up front. And sometimes even like depending on the character of the child, not even that, one of my kids had allergies, which were really bad, which had me like not know what to do. So there's that. But I think one doesn't exclude the other. Yes, the kid's there, and yes, or the dog's there, and you knew what you were getting into, and you can still be bummed that, you don't get to go out so much anymore, that you always have to freaking plan for a dog sitter or a babysitter, and it can't be spontaneous anymore. And it's, and not to beat yourself up about it, because I think that's what we do then. We make it go like, if only I loved my kid enough, or if only I loved my dog enough, then I wouldn't care about not being able to do those other things anymore. The fact that that still upsets me means that my love for my kid isn't big enough, or my love for my dog isn't enough, which is nonsense. It can be both.
Exactly. And I don't think you can ever really know what you're getting into, because like you said, you can't take into consideration the way you're going to feel, how deeply you're going to care, what challenges are going to arise, because it's not an object. It's not a, it's not a couch. You don't know how they're going to behave. You don't know what injuries they're going to get, what illnesses they're going to get, and, what emotional struggles they're going to get. So you just never really do know what you're getting into, I don't think.
So true. I think maybe this is where I then ask you, like I ask everyone else, to comment on the three words that are always the same, which are expectation, frustration, and celebration in relation to life with your dog. Take it away.
I think so. Expectation, I think, is a lot of what causes issues. I think our expectations, society's expectations, is what stops us from being happy. Because when we expect our dog to look a certain way, when we expect things to go a certain way and it doesn't, that leads us on to the second one, which that's what causes frustration, is because we had these expectations. So I think it's almost trying to remove that one of perhaps not having any expectations and just thinking, okay, this is how it's going, this is good, and taking each day by day. So I think that's my thoughts on that. Frustration, I don't know. I'm learning to quite like frustration, because I see it a lot. I have we see it a lot in reactivity. We see it a lot in aggression. It's where a lot of things come from, is feeling frustration. It's really has a really negative thing. And I see a lot in my child. She's frustrated, but I think her frustration comes from, she's too little for her brain. She's too young for her brain, and she wants to do so much more. So, and that's what frustration, comes from. We're not able to get access to the things we want. So perhaps we could drive frustration into more of a positive thing and mean that it's progression and it's telling us to move forwards and to keep going. But perhaps it just means we need to keep it steadier, and celebration. I think we should do that all the time. I'm trying to work on that now, is when I have a little wing, I think, I have a little glass of champagne and celebrate that, whatever it is. And even if it's just on my own, if I'm like, I did this today, I'm going to celebrate that. I think that's so important, that we celebrate all the little things that happen. My dog didn't have any reactions today. You know what? I'm gonna make myself a nice meal, or whatever you do to celebrate. I think that's really important, because that's where we're going. That can be our goals. We don't have to have big goals. It can just be that we're moving forwards with what we want to do.
Yeah, consciously pointing our brains towards all the positives in a day, and they don't have to be huge at all. And when you take that cap off of it, you find so many more wins every day.
Yeah, definitely. I've started playing a game with my daughter. So every dinner time we say what we liked about the day and what we didn't like about the day. And what I found really interesting was I come up with so many things I liked, and I struggle to find things I didn't like. Whereas when you're going through the day, you're kind of like, oh, you feel a bit irritated by things. And when I sit down and we say that, I'm like, I like this, I like this. And sometimes she says, what didn't you like? And I say, oh, actually can't think of anything I really actually didn't like. I mean, looking back. So I think that's a really good game to play, just to practice that gratitude and that, and realize that perhaps what you thought was a bad day wasn't necessarily as bad as you first thought.
Yeah, and that's definitely the result of asking your brain to look for positives, you know, then it, because then it just starts to tune out the negatives. It focuses on what you ask it. I love that. Well, what if people ask where they can find you? Where would you tell them to go?
So they can find me on to the Trickworth. So I'm on Instagram, I'm on TikTok and YouTube. Try and go on them all on Facebook. I'm probably most active on Instagram, so you know, I'm quite responsive there, whereas I don't want to sort of, you know, put myself on social media all day. So you're probably more likely to get a response on Instagram. And then my website is trickworths.com. And I have, lots of cartoons on there. So if people aren't on social media, I'm adding more cartoons to the website so that people that perhaps don't want to be in that environment can go there. And have little courses and a membership just for those who may be struggling with challenging behaviors.
Okay, tell me a little bit more about that membership. What is that?
So it's got lots of courses on, and it's got a support chat. So if people are on there, they can just send me a quick message like, oh, my dog's doing this, what should I do? Or, you know what, we had a really bad day today and a big reaction, and everybody there is kind of going through similar things. So it's a place to vent, it's a place to ask for help, and it's just me, so you're not going to get sort of loads of conflicting advice from other people and obviously the other people that the other members. And then there's sort of courses like 33 days of mental stimulation, just little things to do with your dog, and constructive walks, and we do have a reactivity one, and just little courses. And I'm doing adding to that a big behavior one, but it's comics, so it's trying to get in depth with a little bit of the hormones and genetics and things, but in a more lighter way.
So cool. And of course it makes sense that you have a community, because that's what we started the episode with, basically the importance of community.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. Well, obviously, as I always say, I'm going to link to all of that in the show notes so people can find it there if they haven't written it down. Although I think Trickwolves is a pretty nice, catchy name, and people will probably be able to remember it if they want to go look for it. Just all that's left for me is to say, Georgie, thank you so much for taking the time out of this incredibly busy schedule, I realize. So I appreciate it even more for coming on the podcast and talking with us.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me. It's been a lovely chat.
You can find the show notes to this episode and everything coaching on my website, kaisavonoverbeek.com. Or you can go find us on Instagram at The Russ Cattle Dog, or maybe even Facebook, Kaisa von Overbeek Coaching. If you like listening to this podcast, might I ask you for a good review on whichever platform you're listening to the podcast to, because it helps us move up in the rating, which helps us be found more easily so that more people can listen to this, more people can benefit from it, more people can feel, as I always say, less alone in where they stand with their dogs.